Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Fred, I've got my favorite magazine, Creation Magazine, here, and I asked you if you could go ahead and not read this current edition. Actually, it's January to March 2010, because I think it's fun to hit you with these articles.
I'm ready.
Not physically hit you. Just run them by you and get your reaction. We'll continue what we started on our last episode together. And this article is on a cuttlefish. You know about those things?
Cuttlefish are really cool.
Oh, they are called the chameleons of the sea. And they have four ways that they change color. And they actually use four different mechanisms. And we're not going to describe them, but I'll just name them. Chromatophore, iridophore, lucifore, and photophore.
All ending in a semaphore?
Yeah. And so, Fred, one of these mechanisms they've used at MIT to create a new kind of brand new kind of TV screen, which is fascinating. But the one I want to talk about is the one that the actual land-dwelling chameleon uses. It's called chromatophore, and it's a group of cells. And in the cell is an elastic sac that holds a pigment. And there are about 20 muscles attached to that sac. And when the creature needs to change color, those muscles stretch out the sac so that that color is now the color that's seen by an observer.
Wow, so that's how it changes colors?
That's how a chameleon, and that's one of the four ways that a cuttlefish changes color. Isn't that awesome?
Oh, it is. I'd recommend if you get a chance, go on the internet to TED. Just remember this, TED TV and octopus.
TED TV.
And octopus, and put that into the search engine, and the first thing will pop up is something on TED TV called Underwater Astonishments, and they show a cuttlefish in there, and it shows how it changes color and pattern.
Imagine a zebra's stripes on a fish, but where the stripes move across the body.
That's right.
It's astounding. Well, it turns out now a chameleon can't do that. Let me describe to the audience why a cuttlefish can make his stripes move down his body. Sort of like a barbershop pole that's spinning and the lines appear to move up.
That's a good analogy.
Right? Yeah. Well, here's what happens. Each of these little sacs, imagine that a chameleon has these sacs, and each sac has a different kind of pigment in it, and about 20 muscles on each sac stretch out that one colored pigment when it wants to change colors. That's astounding.
Wow.
And the other color shrinks. So the chameleon just changed colors. Well, the cuttlefish can do the same thing, but it has an extra level of sophistication. Each of the sacs has a nerve going to it that can allow finer control. And so while the sacs with a certain color, some of them are turned on while others are turned off. It's not like all the sacs of the same color automatically get turned on. No. So you have some of the browns being turned on while the browns right next to them are being turned off. And then that goes in sequence and the stripes move down the body of the cuttlefish.
That sounds like a system that has to be designed and in place and not something that, you know, happens slowly over millions of years and random change.
Yeah, you're a software engineer, Fred. Imagine trying to design, write the software to do that. That's awesomely sophisticated.
Oh, and not just the software, but the hardware. I mean, I have to blame the hardware engineers for all the problems because that's impossible to do for me.
Yeah, right. It's so extraordinary. And then it's going to happen by one mutation after another, building up over millions of years till you get this extraordinary light show going on. And when I say light show, yeah, some of the color of the cuttlefish is structural color, where it's not even pigment. That's how MIT designed a brand new kind of TV screen.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. It's amazing how scientists will use designs in nature from the ultimate engineer, the ultimate designer, to do things like design TVs. I wasn't aware of that until you mentioned it to me. But, you know, there's so many examples, you know, like, the, you know, they studied the flying squirrel, NASA did, for years because of its amazing abilities. And we can go on and on.
Yeah.
The camouflage of the monarch butterfly is just amazing.
And how about when the monarch butterfly, the step before that, the chrysalis, where a caterpillar builds a case around itself, liquefies itself, and emerges as a flying, beautiful creature. I mean, how do you evolve that? How do you evolve where you put yourself in your own little coffin and you liquefy yourself and you come back full of life and flight? Fred, what kind of species is going to survive liquefying itself? Well, imagine the first caterpillar that thought, you know what, I'm getting tired of not being able to get around quickly. I'm going to liquefy myself.
What kind of person can believe that happened by chance?
Oh,
my goodness.
Yeah, it's just absurd.
Yeah, that whole caterpillar to butterfly is like one of the millions of nails in the coffin for evolution.
Millions of nails in the coffin. That's right. Okay, Fred, Creation Magazine, they have an update on a story we covered about the squid found by the British Geological Survey, and they have a quote from their Dr. Phil Wilby. This squid is supposed to be 150 million years old. And do you remember that story, Fred? Remember what they found?
Yeah, they found ink. They could write with it.
They found ink in the squid that's supposed to be 150 million years old.
150 million years old. Just try to imagine how old that is.
That, I mean, that's, it's old.
That is.
Imagine finding the printing press that first made the Gutenberg Bible, good old Gutenberg's printing press, and imagine finding some of that ink and thinking it's still going to be usable. And that's just half a millennia ago. Now imagine 10,000 years ago, 100,000, a million years ago, 150 million years ago, and here's what Dr. Phil Wilby of the British Geological Survey, he said, it is difficult to imagine how you can have something as soft and sloppy as an ink sac fossilized in three dimensions and still black and inside a rock that is 150 million years old. Yeah, it is hard to imagine, isn't it? That's because it's not possible. By the laws of physics, it's not possible.
Well, just by molecular motion, wouldn't that ink have broken down over at least a million years would have done it, don't you think?
Well, yeah, you have molecules, they vibrate, atoms, they vibrate. And so it's that whole order to disorder thing. And when you have complex biological molecules, they break down. And so for bacteria to survive for tens of millions, hundreds of millions of years, living bacteria, Fred, they have living bacteria supposedly that has survived without food or water or anything for hundreds of millions of years.
Amazing. So, you know, I'm starting to think, well, maybe they're not millions of years old. Maybe we're talking thousands.
I think so. And all the soft tissue dinosaur finds nowadays. All right. So next story is on dog hair.
Dog hair. Okay.
Dog hair. Are you allergic to dogs?
No, but my wife is. So we do not have dogs.
Okay.
So, and we don't have a cat. She wants a cat, but I said we'd have to name it Fourth and Long. So that got the point across.
Okay. All right. So you guys don't have pets. We don't have pets, but I love animals.
I do too.
They're delicious. And our, you know, of our boys, Dominic absolutely loves dogs. And so he loves our neighbor's dogs, and that's fine with us.
Well, we've actually got pets. I've got like 10. Well, actually, I could more if you count all the bacteria. Well, I got a saltwater tank.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
So those are called pets?
Well, you know, the kids have given them names. And I've got a plaque on there that says God's works, wondrous works were made to be remembered.
Oh, wow. Praise the Lord. So now, you know how the evolutionists say that all the genetic information in living things comes from mutations. And so that's what they say. Well, now they're studying dogs. And they have studied, geneticists have studied 80 breeds of dogs, their DNA, and 1,000 individual dogs from 80 breeds. And what they have found out, they've been able to identify the genes that give the dog its particular kind of coat. Like whether it has short or long hair, curly or not, and in a wavy, and even some of the furnishings like a mustache or bushy eyebrows, you know, dogs that look like that. And Fred, here's what they found out, that there's mutations in just three genes account for almost all the variation in the types of coats. Mutations in three genes.
And that actually is not surprising, Bob.
It's not surprising.
It's not surprising.
Right. And so it turns out that this is the opposite of the evolutionary story, because the genes are there. The genes are what describe how to create this coat of hair for this dog. And mutations in those genes produce variation. The mutations didn't produce the coat of hair. The mutations produce the variation.
That's right. And there's very little genetic variability in, for example, skin color, the depth of your pigment, melanin.
Mm-hmm.
So very little genetic variability dictates how much melanin you have. You know, we're all actually right. The same color. Some of us just have more or less of melanin than right. The other person.
Right, right.
And same with, you know, our eyes, the way our eyes are shaped. I believe, and I can't remember specifically, Bob, but I think it's just one mutation that dictates
Oriental, more slanted eyes.
It's very few.
Now, watch out, political correctness. We probably just committed some, you know, felony or something, Fred. But, yeah, that is a mutation. That has to do with how much fat, how many fat cells are in the eyebrow.
That's right.
Or the eyelid, in the eyelid. I forget which.
And to me, I almost hate to use the word mutation.
Oh, not the eyebrow. Let me say that. So that has to do with how many fat cells are in the eyelid, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, no, I believe that's the case. And, you know, I almost don't like calling it a mutation, because some of these are actually control variables in a gene to give you the variability. When you hear the word mutation, you think of mistake.
Right.
Well, some of these aren't mistakes.
The things they think are mistakes are actually designed variations.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Like, for example, lactose intolerance. That, are you familiar with the latest on, they used to say there was a disease called lactose intolerance. Now they're saying, no way, that actually that was the original design of mankind, was that after you're weaned, gradually you have a genetic switch that stops your ability to produce lactase, so you can't digest lactose in milk. And because of three different mutations that they have tracked now all over the world, human beings are developing an ability to digest lactose, which we didn't have originally. And so our switches, they're not being switched right. It's fascinating.
It is. That's very interesting.
Yeah. So, okay, Fred, next story. Turns out that some planets orbit backwards.
Backwards? I think that's going to be a problem for some of our evolutionist friends.
Yeah, I think so, because the story is that a gas cloud will contract and create a star in the planet system around it. Well, if that's true, then you would expect that all the planets would orbit in the same way as their star rotates, and all the moons around the planets would orbit and rotate in the same way. Well, now we find out that, I could give you the names of these two planets, but they're WASP and HAT. Turns out that they are orbiting very close to their stars, about 1,000 light years from Earth. And Fred, they're orbiting backward in the opposite direction of their star's spin.
And I know that there's a physical law called the conservation of angular momentum.
Mm.
And what does that say?
Yeah, it tells you if you have a condensing spinning nebula that everything is going to keep spinning in the same way, unless you have some extraordinary consequence, like some nearby heavenly body comes and somehow disrupts the whole system.
That's right. And so to give the audience kind of a picture of this, imagine, I've seen this example before, where you've got kids on a merry-go-round and they want to be spin really, really fast. They get to go on too fast.
Mm.
Well, as they spin off the merry-go-round, they're going to all spin the same direction.
The
they're
kids,
not going to spin backwards. They're going to spin the same direction.
And so we could picture flying kids spinning off a merry-go-round or a ball. You put a ball on a merry-go-round, you spin it, that ball will start spinning in the same direction. And as it flies off the merry-go-round, it will be spinning in the same direction as the merry-go-round.
And that's a law of science. It's never been violated.
Right. But we have Venus in our own solar system that spins backwards. It rotates backwards. And so they say, oh, well, of course, that could happen if you have this, you know, wild occurrences, secondary, tertiary assumptions. But then how about, what do we have, 10 moons that spin backwards? And to be able to take a planet and keep it in its beautiful elliptical orbit and just make it spin backwards?
You know, they could maybe have an excuse if one of them was like that and then come up with some goofy idea of how that happened.
Right.
But there's so many examples in our galaxy alone, in our solar system, of planets rotating backwards.
Right, right.
From other planets.
So this is a problem, and the atheists, they realize that things like this are major problems. Retrograde, rotation, orbiting backwards. But that's what happens when your worldview is inaccurate, then the large observations don't necessarily match with your worldview's predictions.
Boy, doesn't that happen a lot with the secular evolutionists? They're wrong all the time.
It really does. Like 99% of the mass of the solar system is in the sun, yet 99% of the spin of the solar system is in the planets.
That's why we always have so much to talk about on this show.
That's right. It's really fun. All right, Real Science Friday with Bob Inyart and Fred Williams. So, Fred, totally different topic. There are dinosaur tracks that are written up in this edition of Creation Magazine, and they're getting this from PLOS-1, Public Library of Science. And, Fred, it turns out that they have in the USA, in Utah, they have dinosaur tracks, and they see where they got a beautiful trail of dinosaur footprints. They see where the dinosaur dragged its tail, and then they see where the dinosaur sat down, and they have the impressions of its small front paws in the sand, which, by the way, turned to rock. That's how it preserved all these delicate markings. And then they saw this, Fred. And this just is tremendous. They saw this, and believe it or not, the only thing the atheist authors could find themselves to discuss is how the dinosaur could rotate its forearm. That's all they got to discuss. But listen to this. They saw scratches in the sand, claw mark tracks, indicating that these dinosaurs were swimming in deep water, and they were just managing to scratch their claws along the sand on the bottom. So they see tracks in the sediment, and then they see the animal's tail. Then they see it sits down, and then they see the dinosaurs are in deep water and clawing the bottom, and then it all fossilizes.
Well, what's interesting when you started telling the story, because I have not heard this before, is when you said the dinosaur sat down, I thought, well, you know, all the evidence we have of dinosaur footprints around the world, it's always of them running from something. They're trying to get away from, obviously, a flood. This was a global flood. So when you said they sat down, I'm thinking, well, this is strange. This might have been one that thought, well, I know I'm doomed. I'm going to sit down, eat my popcorn, and just watch the show.
Right. And so it's trying to get away from rising floodwaters. It maybe is exhausted. It falls down. And then the water is rising, and you see just its scratches of its nail prints on the surface of the sand. Now, imagine if an evolutionist would say, well, that's just dinosaurs going through a pond. Well, isn't it funny that you've got the footprints, and then the tail, and then the sitting down, and then the water, and it's floating, and it's just barely scratching the bottom, and then it all fossilizes. I mean, that just doesn't happen. The bottom of ponds don't just fossilize. We have dinosaur tracks fossilized all over the world.
Pretty good evidence of a global catastrophe.
Yeah, I really think so. Okay, next article. How about this? Scientist Fred, we're looking at chimpanzees and young children. And they were trying, you know how evolutionists think, well, chimps, human beings are a lot like chimps and apes, were just a little bit more evolved, so chimps should be able to do the kinds of things we do. Well, it turns out now that they're saying we're not closest to chimps after all. We're closer to orangutans. But that's a different article. But that cracks me up. That just flat out cracks me up. The geneticists are
saying.
My
wife might agree with that.
It is just so funny. I mean, supposedly, remember how close human and chimp DNA was? And that proved that we were so close. Now, the chimps are farther from us than orangutans.
Wow.
Well, maybe we're more like a sponge. So anyway, Fred, it turns out they created this test where they gave young children ages 3 and 4 years old a stick to put into a hole in a box to scoop out honey. And they did the same thing with the chimps. So the chimps are able to put a stick in a hole, scoop out and lick the stick to get honey. Well, then they showed by using their hands, the researchers, they showed the children and the chimps that if you just tip the stick sideways, it'll unlatch the box and you could not only get all the honey you want, but you get peanuts too.
Oh, man.
And so the kids, the little kids, they all could do it. And they sit them down by the box, they put the stick in, they put it sideways and it opens up and they eat the peanuts.
But the chimpanzees?
Not one of the chimps could do that.
Oh.
After being shown over and over and over, here's how you could get it. And so the atheists, they're discouraged because they want chimps to be on a continuum to human beings.
Well, Bob, you know, this is kind of reminds me of a funny story. True story, I was debating on the Yahoo creation board many years ago. And one of the scientists that was debating on that board said that if we put a chimp through our public schools, he'd have the intelligence of a third grader by the time he got through the 12 grades of education. And I told him, you know, there's a grain of truth to that, probably, with the state of our public school system.
But it has nothing to do with the IQ of a chimp. An article in New Scientist, the Evolution magazine, says this, Fred. Chimps will never create steam engines, stone pyramids, or even a simple wheel.
I have seen them create one thing, though.
In
this same magazine, Creation Magazine, I think about 2 or 3 years ago, a chimp painted an amazing picture. And they showed it to, art critics, and quite a few of them thought this was an amazing piece of art. They thought a human did it.
Yeah.
And then they found out it was just random gibberish by a chimpanzee.
Right, which doesn't really praise the chimp. It condemns modern art.
That's right. Well, it condemns the critic for thinking that was any good.
And, yeah, if the definition of art is if I can do it, it's not art. And you go to the Denver Museum of Art. And they had the scientist come in from another country, spend 2 weeks, paid a ton of money, and she got some fish netting, hung it from the ceiling, and she went to, like, the Goodwill and Salvation Army, and she bought all plastic toys and, like, plastic Tupperware pans and all, and she filled the plastic netting with all this junk, and that was her display. It couldn't have been more pitiful. It just couldn't have.
And I'm sure that there a lot of the art, you know, experts, what a brilliant display put together by.
And you know what they tell people who go there? They say, now you don't want to make negative comments because you never know if the artist might be there listening.
Is it still there?
Well, it was there when I was there recently.
Wow.
It's just bizarre. Talk about a waste of money and taxpayer money.
Absolutely.
No less. What a tragedy. Okay, so there's another article in New Scientist. And this really is interesting. Fred, in fact, this is what I was just talking about. Sorry, I didn't realize it was the next article. Remember the hype that chimp and human DNA was supposed to prove conclusively that chimps are our closest relatives, Fred? Well, now they're saying, no, it is the orangutan. And right here, this is in Creation Magazine, same issue that we're talking through right now. So, Fred, when they say, hey, we have knockout evidence that the chimps are our closest ancestors, they fabricate arguments because our DNA, the genetic blueprint of all living creatures, plants, animals, fish, birds, reptiles, there's like a toolbox from which God, the creator, designed each different species. And so there's tremendous similarity because he used the toolbox.
Yeah, but the DNA similarity turned out to not be such a powerful argument for the evolutionists. That, you know, they claim that we were 3% similar to chimps. I mean, even that argument isn't solid because that's a lot of differences in the DNA. It's more than people think because that's like 120 million nucleotides that would have to be different. And we know mathematically. And
now they're saying 5% anyway, so it keeps getting bigger.
It keeps getting bigger. And even at 3%, you know, I'm not going to bore everybody with the math, but scientists know that you would have to produce about 60 offspring just to maintain equilibrium, and that was based on a 3% difference. So I don't want to go into the how behind that, but now that when they go to 5%, by the way, that number goes into the 10,000s. It's an illusion of evolution. It's one of the ones that has been more, one of the more persuasive ones of theirs about this DNA similarity. But now that they're seeing that they were not so similar, they're coming up with, they're changing their theory like they do all the time. You know, I remember Walter Remine once said that evolution is like it's a smorgasbord. It's a theory that they've set up not to be falsifiable, and the data adapts to the landscape like fog, you know.
Yeah, falsifiable. Ask an evolutionist, well, what could disprove Darwinism? What could disprove it? And they can't conceive of anything that could disprove it. And that is a mark of a bad theory.
That's right.
The New Testament says if Jesus Christ did not rise from the dead, Christianity is false. So Christianity is falsifiable. Here is a specific claim. If this claim is not true, Christianity is false. Darwinism is infinitely pliable. It will embrace any evidence, and they'll say, see, that's just proof of evolution.
Yeah. You know, one example just came to mind is when they find a living fossil, you know, something that was supposed to have gone extinct millions of years ago. Then they find one alive in the world, and their excuse is, oh, that survived in a niche, you know, millions of years without changing.
Like a coelacanth.
They've got an explanation for everything. Their theory is set up to explain any possibility, which makes it not falsifiable.
Right. Okay, last thing, Fred, for this episode of Real Science Friday. There's a college student from California, Joseph Benson, and he writes about the lessons he learns in his atheistic science classes. And he said, when you just pay attention, there's so much evidence for creation, even in our secular biology classes. He gives the example of apoptosis. Have you heard of that, apoptosis?
Well, I have because of Jerry Bergman's article in the Creation Research Society Quarterly.
All right. And that is programmed cell death, right?
That's right.
You have trillions of cells in your body, and they get old. Some of them start malfunctioning. They cause cancer. And so a cell sends out a signal that says, kill me.
Self-destruct?
Self-destruct. And kill me. And literally the cell is eaten. It's destroyed and its raw materials are recycled or expelled from the body. And so Joseph Benson points out that this is against the Darwinist evolutionary, the need to propagate itself.
Survival of the fittest.
Survival, reproduction, because this kind of cell suicide to destroy yourself goes against the evolutionary paradigm. And so this in and of itself, and it's such a sophisticated function, this apoptosis for a cell to give out a message that, okay, I have to be destroyed.
It's part of an elaborate quality control system that we've talked about before on the show. It's amazing the technology in the cell for this quality control. And this is just one of the many mechanisms of this.
Well, Fred, even when we're developing inside of our mother's womb, you know, your fingers are forming, and then the cells that are connecting all your fingers, they go through this apoptosis, and they self-destruct, separating your fingers and your toes.
I think a lot of that is happening in my brain.
So, Fred Williams, thank you so much for joining me on Real Science Friday. Maranatha Christian Center, what a great school, and kgov.com.
This is Bob Inyart inviting you to read our manuscript, The Plot, for an overview of the whole Bible. Call us at 800-836-9278. That's 836-9278.